Hello and welcome to Against the Grain. This is Zach Martinucci, and today I want to tell you about what I learned studying pasta and gelato in Italy. Not kidding. Plus, what the beginnings of our bread pop-up events are looking like. If we've talked about food in real life, you know that I secretly cringe at the word authentic. I tell a lot of stories about Italian grandmothers, I sometimes talk about food like a professor, and I am very particular about my gelato. I'm hoping that what I tell you today will help make all of that make sense. Also, everything I've talked about in this podcast so far has been my attempt at welcoming you into my perspective on food in the world. While each episode is a part of that conversation, this one in particular is going to be in two parts. Part one, a case study from Bologna, Italy, and next week, part two, how all of this applies to bread. I studied culinary anthropology at UCLA, and my undergraduate thesis brought me to Bologna, Italy to study food traditions. My project looked at how local identity and culture are represented in the food that people cook and eat, and in particular, how food can be a response towards a perceived threat of identity loss that comes with globalization. Now, I'll spare you all the academic jargon that comes with that last sentence, because a lot of the project concentrated on studying the remaking of traditions as a form of resistance, not in up-in-arms, take-to-the-streets kind of way, but through the tension of claiming one's identity when there's tourism and immigration and global changes of all kinds. And for the most part, people aren't cooking with the intention of resisting global movements. That's just what social scientists tend to take by studying some of these phenomena. The point being that we can study contemporary issues through food. My day-to-day research was spent going from homes and restaurants to markets, factories, and farms to understand cultural, social, and economic practices of food. I stayed with families and cooked with their grandmothers, I attended cooking classes, I helped in bakeries, and visited markets, manufacturers, and farms, all looking to understand how traditional knowledge is passed down, how it's contextualized within local land and identity, and how it might be changing in any way. People claim value in their food and traditions in a variety of ways. We often look to how authentic something is, and authenticity is crafted in many different ways. For example, you could assert a claim of naturalness, or terroir, the taste of place, or historic value, or through the traditional process in which something is made. There's not one kind of authenticity. Trying to assign a marketable value of authenticity does lead to tension over defining these traditions and identity. And I argued that these tensions are manifested in local food and in the discourses over what is authentic, who gets to claim that, and how traditions are maintained in a globalized world. There are two standout examples that I want to tell you about. Two of my favorite foods, tortellini and gelato. And if you're like me, you might at first be surprised about how much we have to learn from pasta and ice cream, but these two culinary traditions are going to help demonstrate for us two very different ways in which authenticity is claimed. Let's start by talking about tortellini, the iconic pride and joy of the city, containing all of the traditional bolognese meats and cheeses wrapped up into one sfoglia, or bolognese-style pasta dough. We'll look at tortellini as they embody a struggle for authenticity in the presence of big industry, foreign influence, and new cultural changes. I got to spend time with Alessandra Spisni, who founded a cooking school in the heart of Bologna. Alessandra is this colorful, spunky woman that does not mess around in the kitchen, but jokes with a playful and sarcastic sense of humor. She opened La Vecchia Scuola Bolognese, or the Old Bolognese School, in 1993, intending to teach local recipes to housewives and families. She would later become popular among Italians and foreigners. Alessandra and her brother consider themselves integralisti, what we might call traditionalists, even with the often negative connotation of not letting go of the past. She says, quote, "This is the tradition because it was ordinary. Now it's a tradition because it's no longer ordinary," unquote. She realized that the everyday food they make was undervalued to us, she adds, yet was seen as magic by the rest of the world. This presented a marketable opportunity by giving value to their time-honored traditions. But authenticity is a battle, she says. The challenges her business faces reflect the tensions in the local food scene. Alessandra fights to maintain her traditions against big industry that produces similar products but without regard to local processes, immigrants and foreigners who come to Bologna and just want space to express their own customs, and young chefs who she says want to make things like strawberry risotto, and she says that if they want to do that, then they should go to Paris instead. Bologna already has its traditions and needs to maintain them, but she recognizes that these chefs just want to make a name for themselves, and it can be hard to do that when you have a famous parent, and by that she's referring to the heritage of the city. This, of course, is a story about change, and nearly every Italian I spoke with quoted the famous novel about shifting political customs, The Leopard. They say, if we want things to stay as they are, then everything will have to change. So the traditions, too, remain forward-thinking, and their flexibility allows them to be reimagined, repurposed, and remain relevant. Alessandra's recipe for tortellini, that quintessential bolognese-filled pasta, was actually adapted over time. She affirms, quote, tradition is tradition and we don't touch it, unquote. And she calls her own recipe a nice mix of three family recipes. Now, this may seem contradictory considering her apparent ability to adapt despite a strong belief in continuity. And in fact, owning this paradox is her own kind of resistance, bending tradition to fit necessity while holding it under the respectable authority of Bolognese culture, as happens with so many traditions. There are two important points here. One is that tradition can change. And two is when her and her brother tell me that if I were to go back to America and make these same recipes with my own ingredients, they would be delicious, but they would not be authentically Bolognese. And that's because they're ascribing restrictions to the food to help determine what makes it authentic, noting that there are strict conditions, for them especially in history and geography, that must be met to produce an authentic dish. Just down the road is Carpigiani, the world-leading manufacturer of gelato equipment. They provide a different take on the way they craft authenticity around their own traditional product. At the Carpigiani Gelato University, aspiring gelato makers come to learn the theory and techniques behind making an artisanal gelato. But first, there are some things you have to know about the product. One is that unlike tortellini, other than being Italian, there's no clear birthplace of the frozen dessert, so it follows some different rules. And two, there are guidelines of what makes artisanal gelato artisanal. One, for example, is service temperature. Artisanal gelato must be kept at 10 to 20 degrees Fahrenheit. Yet our supermarket shelves are often held at 0 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit. So just by that discrepancy, if you buy something in the supermarket freezer that is labeled gelato, it may be delicious, but it can't be considered an artisanal product. There's not one correct recipe, but there are these guidelines in place. Carpigiani creates what they call a customized common guide that is meant to render it a global product. Persians like their gelato sweeter. Scandinavian gelato has a higher fat content, and when one of their instructors helped open a gelato shop in Atlanta, they put gummy bears in the gelato. And let me tell you, that is an insult of Italian gelato, but Italian gelato isn't always the point. Carpigiani has found success in embracing new approaches to their product, and flexibility is important for a business selling equipment for a 500-year-old dessert if it's going to remain relevant in a global market today. Back at the cooking school, Alessandra's brother would agree that, quote, tradition belongs to those who cook with their hands, unquote. So in a world of industrial ice cream, Carpigiani resists by encouraging gelato makers to explore with their recipes and participate in the passing of cultural knowledge through relationships. And gelato is supposed to change as it travels, but the guidelines maintain a quality standard for the product as a whole. No culture exists in a vacuum. And even though cultures have traditions, it doesn't mean they can't change. In our two examples of producing authentic tortellini and gelato, you might say that the soul of those recipes or of those foods, one of them is rooted in local ingredients and family traditions, the other more in technique and guidelines for a base product. And I bet you could find a third explanation too. So who's right? Is one somehow more authentic? Well, I don't think there's an objective correct version of defining authenticity or value in a particular food. I think it's more important that we have this conversation, and that's why I bring it up today. I know this is a lot, so to see what I mean, next time you're at the store and you're buying potato chips or whatever, notice if the package is advertising their home-style family recipe, or innovative air pop technique, or unique flavor varieties, or potatoes from a specific part of the world? Are your favorite restaurants known as local gems, time-honored establishments? Are they trendy pop-ups? Are they traditional or modern? There's room for everyone, of course. You can value tradition and innovation in the way you eat. Both ends of the spectrum, and everything in between, are valid and significant and necessary in our lives. Different strokes for different folks. I just ask that the next time you make a decision about where or what you're going to eat, to notice what the restaurant or food stands for, and maybe what that says about you. Next week, we'll bring this into the context of bread, because I think the baking choices I make say a lot about who I am and what I care about. Project updates. So I'm getting out there into the world, and here's what's new. I've been fortunate enough to sit down with some well-connected foodie community entrepreneur peeps, and they've had some great advice and perspective on how to introduce Rebel Bread to Denver. I'm also looking forward to coffee with a new bread friend next week. And just yesterday, we had the first stop on the Rebel Bread Tour, a series of pop-up bread shops in Denver community spaces. The idea being that both right now and long-term, I want to bring Rebel Bread to places where people like to hang out or socialize, coffee shops, yoga studios, barbershops, breweries, but where bread probably is not. Yesterday, we were in Amethyst Coffee Company, and I have to give a big thank you to Elle and the Amethyst team for being so supportive and accommodating. I got to set up a table in the coffee shop on a Saturday morning, and I cut slices of bread for people to sample with butter and jam and Nutella, and I sold whole and half loaves of the classic San Francisco sourdough. And people liked it. I have to tell you, I was mentally preparing myself for my first Denver bread sale ever. Who is it going to be? Were we going to, like, congratulate each other or something? And then this couple walks up while I'm still setting up and says, "Oh, bread, we should have that for breakfast. We'll take a half loaf. Maybe you could slice it for us, and we'll take some jam." And I said, "Okay, thank you." And just like that, I sold Denver its very first loaf of Rebel bread so casually as it probably should have been all along. I sold out in an hour, and more than that, I got to have all the conversations I had been hoping to have by bringing Rebel into a community space. I talked to home bakers who were excited to see bread and asked me some questions. I spoke with people who just saw some Netflix food documentary or another and have been looking for real sourdough. I met people who saw us on Instagram and wanted to come check us out. And I was pleasantly surprised by the people that just saw the table and said, "Hey, I'm going to lunch with my family after this," or, "I want to surprise my boyfriend," or, "I'm going to see my dad tomorrow, and I would love to bring them some bread." That is everything I could have hoped for and more. I can't sell bread from my desk, and getting out into the world was nerve-wracking, knowing that strangers would be paying real money, expecting a real product, and they would have real feedback. I'm already thinking about how to do the next one differently, and now I have to figure out a way to bake more bread at a time, because I want to have more of those interactions at the next pop-up. Speaking of which, next week, both Rebel Bread and Little Bites Bakery will be at the Market Beautiful, a vintage and antique market event in North Denver. We'll have filled-to-order donuts, and I'll be making some bostocks, which are like a Danish but with filling on top of the entire thing. I'm also still booking venues, so to speak, for this introductory Rebel Bread tour. If you're a community space, like a coffee shop, or you frequent a space that needs our bread, send me an email at zach@rebelbread.com. And then keep up with our Instagram, @RebelBreadDenver, to find out where we're going to be next. We've got some exercise studios and coffee shops lined up for this spring, and I'd love to see you there. Next week, Being Authentic, Part 2. And now that I'm out there in the world, it feels like there's some momentum happening, and who's to say what's going to happen, but I'll tell you about it next Sunday. Have a great week. I couldn't help myself with the music this week. This was La Traviata Brindisi from the MIT Symphony Orchestra on Free Music Archive.